Hi, and welcome to the third module of software engineering. In this module, we'll discuss software processes. Now, a software process describes how software is developed in an organization. And typically a process, it identifies three important aspects, something called the activities, the artifacts, and the agents. The activities of a process describes the things that need to be done, such as design, implementation, and testing. The artifacts are what is produced in the process. For example, the code files, the test cases, and the documentation. The agents again describe who is responsible for the various activities and artifacts. Well, while this might sound a bit theoretical, I assure you it is extremely practical. It's all about who should be doing what, when, and that is, in most cases, very, very useful to know. If we look at the structure of this module, you can see that we again have three readings. We have one chapter in the book and two papers. The book chapter gives a short overview of the various software processes that exist, and the paper goes a bit more into depth. The first paper discusses iterative and incremental software development and gives a history of when many of the ideas that we still see today in modern approaches in agile and lean software development, when these emerged and how they have evolved over time. Well, as you know, software development is often a very hype-driven field, and therefore I think it's very, very useful for you also to get a sense of history for what ideas are actually new and what are just reused in many of the new hyped approaches that we see. The second paper, another very famous paper, describes how Microsoft and Netscape started to use lightweight software processes that provided flexibility during the browser wars, when Microsoft and Netscape fought about whether the Netscape or Internet Explorer would be the browser on everybody's desktop. And this paper gives us some insight into how software development was structured in a very, very turbulent environment where competition was really cutthroat, and it was essential to get out new features as quickly as possible. I think this makes for some quite interesting reading. Despite the age of the paper, there are several good takeaways. And again, after the readings, you should do the quiz, and you have 30 minutes as always and two takes. You should be used to this by now. And this module also has an essay for you to work on, an essay related to this extremely interesting topic of software processes. So I really hope you enjoy writing that. And also I want you to remind you that you really need to grade three of last week's essays during this week. You can do that by clicking on the essay task back in last week's module. So go back to last week's module, click on the essay, and there you will find the three essays that have been assigned to you for grading. As always, the deadline for the quiz, essay, and grading of last week's essay for everything is next Monday at 8:00 a.m. So please do start working early. If you have general questions about the course, please post them in the Q&A forum as always. However, if you have questions related to grading the essay in module 2, please use the dedicated forum for that. And with that, let's turn our attention to the topic at hand, software processes. So let's start with looking at what is meant by a software process and why looking at understanding and modeling and improving software processes can be important in software development organizations. What is a software process? What do you think? You don't need to define it formally, but do you have any idea what we mean by a software process?
Would it happen to be a process that's part of the activity of software engineering?
Yes. Software process. First of all, if we start looking into what typically is meant by a process, let's start there. Webster, the dictionary, defines it as a continuing development, so it's something that goes on and on. And typically we want to add that it contains some kind of method to it. So it's a particular method for doing something, usually involving a number of steps or operations. And the IEEE defines it as a sequence of steps performed for a given purpose. So when we talk about the software process, it basically, by that we mean the process for developing and maintaining, deploying and so on, software. A more formal definition from CMMI, we were talking about the CMMI, a capability maturity model, at the end of the course. But it's a set of activities, methods, practices and transformations that we use to develop and maintain software and the associated products. What you can remember when we talk about software process, basically it's the way we develop software in an organization. Quite often we hear people saying that, well, you know, we have this company, we do this software, but we don't have any process. That's not really true. You do have a process. It might not be defined, it might not be measured, it might not be managed, it might not be understood. But the way you develop software is your software process. The field of software engineering contains lots of software processes that you probably have heard of, like extreme programming, Scrum, RUP, Rational Unified Process, the waterfall model, and so on. We will today take a look at these and discuss their benefits, their pros and cons, their structure. These are also sometimes referred to life cycle models because they can cover all aspects of the life cycle of a software system from the inception when you get an idea to build it till the end, till you retire it, you take it out of use. But before that, let's think for a second about why we should care about the software process. Why should we at all be interested in the organizational process of software development?
Well, first of all, if it's a bad software process, you will lose money. And
bad in what sense?
Slow.
So a slow process that's not efficient would waste money because it costs too much, yeah?
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
So we'd be interested because we want efficient processes.
Yeah, right. Efficiency is the word.
Very good. Let me show you one model that was developed in the field of management many, many years ago that tries to explain the role of a process in an organization. You might also remember that Fred Brooks, in his article No Silver Bullet, also said that process is one area in which we can expect big benefit. So this model is known as Leavitt's Diamond. It's old, from 1965. What it says is that an organization that works can be viewed as consisting of four different parts. We have the structure, that would be the hierarchy, the org chart, and the way decisions are made. We have the people with knowledge, skills, needs, and motivation. We have the technology, the tools, computers, things. And then we have the process, which are the practices, procedures, and instructions, the way we work. And for an organization to be efficient, all of these need to be aligned and be working well. And we all know that there is no such thing as a perfect organization. This can be seen, for example, in the ongoing changes that big organizations do between centralization and decentralization, between having centralized management and a very strict control versus having independent business units. We have seen many big organizations change between these two. But that would be an example of structure. We all, software development organizations, know our most important assets when we develop software in an organization are our people, their knowledge, their skills, and their motivation. However, only in recruiting talks and in business presentations, we hear every time that we have only the best people. But we all know that if we have a certain amount of coders that get hired, not all of them are the best. So we have people with different skill levels, we have people with different motivation, and so on in organizations. So we have a different set of people that we need to work with. We have technology that is becoming more and more standard, where we can see lots of variation and where there seems to be a lot of room for improvement is in how software is developed. Actually, if you look at reports of failure, software failures, and software project statistics, the most common reason for failure are related to human issues. This is very bad news for us as engineers. We'd like to build a new tool that will solve all problems on software engineering. If we look at the reasons projects fail, it's because people don't talk, they don't communicate well. It's difficult, as you know, to visualize software, so people misunderstand each other. When we do multicultural projects or multi-site projects, people from different sites don't trust each other.
we do a poor job of planning, and we do a poor job of managing. So we see the main issues we see these days are related to communication, or lack of communication and lack of trust in projects. It's very seldom the fact that a project is a huge failure because the version control system didn't work or we had the wrong compiler. Those are not the reasons that we have these huge overruns and these huge failures. It's almost always related to human issues, either mistakes made by humans or complete disasters from a project management point of view. So software engineering is as much about people as, of course, having the skill necessary software development and software design skills. So process, as this picture says here, it's one of the main things that we need to work with when we want to improve how organizations do software engineering. But let's start with a look at different kind of software process models. So what a software process model does, and we are now talking about high level prescriptive, that is models that say this is how you should do things. High level models of software development processes that describe a large part or the whole part of a software system. So they are also sometimes referred to as life cycle models. And the phases or activities that they include typically are requirement, specification, design, implementation, testing, deployment, that is taking the system into use, maintenance, changing it, and so on, and retirement, that is taking it out of use, replacing a system, typically with another system. Before we go into the life cycle models, let's talk about the build and fix model. That is the so-called Teekkarimalli. It looks something like this. You open the computer, you code the first version, and then you hack and change and recompile and hack some more, debug, recompile, test, and then you do that until either yourself or somebody else is satisfied. And that's it. Then you maybe maintain it if you give it to somebody, and then you do a lot of the same. And then at some point in time, nobody uses the software anymore. Do you see any problems here? Or should we just say, oh, you know, this is life. This is how software is developed for real.
Well, first of all, even though this iterative process might be fine, you are missing sort of structure, specifications, and estimate future.
So why would we need, what is the problem with not having specifications or requirements?
Well, if you don't know what you're going to do, you might do something wrong.
You might do something wrong, and let's say you have a client who wants to pay you a fixed price. How can you estimate how much money you need for something that you don't know, because you have never asked what you're supposed to do, right? So you don't know when you're done. You're done when the client says you're done.
No definition of done.
No definition of done for the project. Actually, when we go to strict incremental and iterative development process models and agile models, there's something actually that resembles this, but there's a much more structure in there. So this is difficult because you don't know when you're done. So this model might work fine for doing small exercises on courses and small exercises by yourself, but this is typically not very applicable to larger projects for working, for example, in a team. So there's no specification, there's no design, so you will let the code evolve. It's very difficult to distribute work to other people. There's a lack of visibility into the project, so if you want to know how far along you are, you have no idea. It has been shown empirically to lead to poorly structured systems. It is also one of the main criticisms against agile development. There is no architectural or design phase there, so they can lead to poorly structured systems. This is not really a good way to develop software professionally. What software engineering, how it got started, was that in the 1960s, most systems were developed like this. And projects had problems, so they didn't keep their schedules. It took a long while. They had lots of quality problems. It was declared that we have a software crisis. Projects are taking too long. They are delivering poor software at high cost. We need to do something. Then they coined the idea, we need to stop being artists when we develop software. We need to be engineers. How do engineers work? So they said, well, you know, if you build a bridge, first you measure the river, and then you try to figure out how much weight you should be able to carry, and so on. So you try to understand the problem first, right? We should do the same thing in software. We should understand the requirements. And only when we have thoroughly understood the requirements, then we can go on to the next phase. And what is the next phase? When you have all the specifications for your bridge, what you do next is you make drawings. This is the bridge, and this is my calculation. So you do the design. And only when the design has been reviewed and understood and everybody knows that, yes, this is going to be a perfect bridge, the best bridge in the world, then you get all the people to build it. And when you have built it to a good design, to the right specifications, then your bridge will be perfect.
I would like to offer you that software is not a bridge, as in bridge costs millions or billions, whereas you can make a few lines of code easily. So it's much more viable to prototype.
It can be very debatable. For small systems, yes. For large systems, software can cost many, many, many bridges. If you look at big systems, you look at the overrun, cost overruns in some systems, even in Finland, can be in the hundreds of millions of euros. And that is the cost overrun of big software projects. So we are not talking peanuts here. For small systems, for things developed by five guys for 3 months, the cost is low, so there's less risk. But the argument that software is not complex or it's not money involved doesn't hold for big projects. But you are absolutely right in that software is not a bridge. And if you read Brooks's article, you know that the thing with bridges is that we have physical laws, that we understand it's a tangible product that we can visualize, we know how to calculate, and so on. We can do many things with it that is very difficult to do with software. And this is actually one of the reasons that the waterfall model, as this sequential model that was built, it looks something like this. We do a requirements phase, we try to understand what to build. Typically, the waterfall model is strictly document-driven. So everything is written down in documents and then approved. So people sign off and say, yes, these are the requirements. This is what my system should do. And then you go to the next phase, which would be the specification. So that is, for example, you have a requirements phase saying that the system must be responsive. That would be a requirement, a bad requirement. But then in the specification stage, if you have a separate stage, then we said, so responsive means that the maximum allowed response time under all possible load circumstances must be 200 milliseconds. That would be a specification. That is when you do things, plan things at the detailed level, saying not how the system should do it, but what, but at a very detailed level. And then you get an even thicker bunch of paper that somebody signs off and says, yes, this is the specification for our system. And this is sequential in the sense that it's built to be difficult and expensive to change. So let's say you are in the specification phase and you get a new requirement. Then you go back to the requirements phase, you open the document, you change it, and then you need to have a new review, a formal approval that, yes, now this changed version 1.1 of the document is the one we are working with. And then you do the same thing with the specification, and so on. It lets you find a problem in the testing or integration testing phase very late that requires changes to the requirements. Then you do update all those documents and have lots of meetings with approvals and sign-offs for all documents before you actually can do the change. So this model is built to make change difficult. Yes?
Short comment, maybe quite obvious for the previous one, the paper model that Bill and this is something, when somebody starts programming and starts learning, you think that's something you perhaps do by yourself, but then it's the bad thing to get stuck into it and apply that professionally. I can tell you my experience that it's from that stage, jumping to this waterfall model where this 95% of documentation and 1% of code and 4% of frustration, it's like a code shower that was like 5 years ago.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. This is far from, and this is, of course, you are already getting at where we are going. There are strengths to this model, but there are very, very severe problems, which is one reason that many organizations are moving away from a pure waterfall model these days to other models. So we have every phase done in sequence, then we have document approvals, and then you can see the arrows going up. They are when you find problems and you almost go back to the stage where the problem originates. So you do lots of analysis of where the problem is and so on. Do you see any problems with this model?
Customers, I have seen that basically when you make the requirements, customer approves and say that this is exactly what you want. Then when you go to the maintenance phase, customer says that this isn't what we wanted, or is it misunderstood.
Yeah, exactly. So you see, first of all, customers very often don't know what they want. They know when they see it. And this project, when they see it, that means that that is when you are delivering it, when everything has been integrated and tested. It's way too late. It can be 9 months or a year in many projects, in waterfall projects, before the customer sees any running software. Before that, it's all documentation, often documentation that the customer really doesn't understand, but they say, okay, we'll sign off. So there's a huge time span between when the customer says what the customer thinks they want and you actually show something. And when you show something, then it's too late to change or extremely expensive. And of course, that can make sense for you business-wise because you can charge a lot for the changes. But this is not a way to get a happy customer.
Also, there is no chance for that in that model to do like many phases simultaneously. Let's say if there were like requirements of with different priorities, those that we know for sure we could all already be like implementing and coding. Yeah,
so here everything is implemented at once. Do you see any benefits with this model?
If you sign the specification, you get the client to sign the specification, it's not far from there to signing easy contract for the whole project.
Yes, this is the model lawyers like, because you have stages, you have deliverables of to each stage, and you can assign dates to every stage. This is contractually very good, and then you can also assign penalties. If you miss a deadline, you don't have the requirements done by the promised date, that will cost you this amount a week. And so on. So we have penalties. It's like in the construction industry. If you don't get the walls up by next week, then we will pay you less.
And one thing that came to my mind is that it said that great leaders always answer the question why. And there's the requirements, wants and specifications how, but is there a need for a question why?
That's an excellent point. So you make the point that somebody should say why. That should be part of the requirements. And when we talk more about requirements engineering, we will talk about a type of requirements called business requirements that basically try to answer the question why. If you don't have a question, an answer to the question why, then maybe you shouldn't be building the system in the first place.
I was thinking about some systems, for example, for nuclear power plants or something like that. You really need to have the requirements before you are starting to code it. So I think this model
is good for projects with stable requirements because you plan once. If you can do that, this is the most efficient model. Some aspects of this model is almost also always used when you have very large projects, because if you don't have any overall grasp of what you are going to do, it's very difficult to split work between many teams. Let's say you have hundreds of people, 200 coders. You can't just say, start coding, guys. You need to do some more work before that. So for large projects, typically we need some aspects of specification and design before we then can go into what is becoming much more popular now these days, which is incremental and iterative development or agile development. To recap the waterfall model, it's based upon planning and control, and it's document driven. Every phase produces lots of documents. It's based upon the idea that by doing the homework, that is really working hard on understanding what to build and what would be the best way for this project to build it, we will be much more efficient than if we don't do that, than if we start coding earlier. And in some cases, this is true. For example, we have safety critical systems or systems with very stable requirements, then this might be the best approach. In cases where we have external customers that don't really know what they want and they need to see something before that we really can get reliable information, this would typically not be a very good model. Let's take a brief look at some strengths. This is very manageable. We have clear stages. We can have different specialized people. We can have requirements people doing requirements. We can have designers doing design. We can have coders doing the coding. And we can have testers doing the testing. So we have specialized people. This can be very good in certain cases. Many of the more modern approaches, in particular agile development, have the idea that everybody is supposed to be able to do everything. All teams and all people are interchangeable. And if we go into complex, deep products, that is in many cases not true at all. Teams can, for technical and knowledge reasons, and people need to be very specialized. But this model works extremely well with specialized knowledge. And it's based upon extensive documentation, which means that if you need to show that this is what we did, this is what we were supposed to do, and this is how we planned it, you need what's called traceability, you get that, because everything is documented and approved and shown if this model is done to the letter. And in certain cases, it's very important to be able to show that for example, safety critical software. Well, so what are the main weaknesses here? One main weakness is the inflexible partitioning into distinct phases. So it supposes that we can do things in sequence. It's difficult to respond to changing customer requirements because this model is built to make change difficult, not to make it easy or agile. And we get feedback on the system, on performance, on usability, on many aspects only after everything has been built and integrated. So this is appropriate when requirements are well understood in very short projects when there's no need to do iterative planning. So very large and very small projects. Very large system projects always have some aspects of waterfall models or more document-driven models, just due to the fact that in order to have a huge organization working somehow efficiently on a big project, you need to have more plans than, say, just take a requirement off a backlog or whatever requirement list and start doing. What does a model like the waterfall lead to? So here you can see what we mean when we say that waterfall makes changes difficult and expensive. This is based upon old data from IBM when they used a very strict waterfall model in the development of some computer operating system software. What you see here is on the x-axis the phases, requirements, specification, design, implementation, integration, and maintenance. And the relative cost of implementing a change. The idea here is that if you figure out the change you needed to do in the requirement stage, it costs one. Let's say it's 1 man-hour. If we figure it out in the specification stage, it's 3 hours. If you figure out in the design stage, it's 4. In implementation, it's 10 times as much. But if we go to integration and maintenance, you can see that it's hugely more expensive because then everything needs to be updated and so on. So this is what this model leads to. And this is one of the main charts that more modern iterative, incremental, and agile approaches try to tackle. They try to say that if you use other ways of developing software than the waterfall model, then when you get changes late in a project, which you always do, it's going to be much cheaper. So the first solution that people came up with for attacking mainly the issue of finding a good architecture and testing usability was the rapid prototyping model. So this says that, hey, why write long, boring requirements documents that the customer doesn't understand? Let's do a rapid prototype instead. Let's hack together something that we can show and discuss with the customer. There are two types of prototypes we can do. We can do a throwaway prototype, which means we can do it on paper. We can do it using a technology that we're not going to use in the final system. And we can do a prototype that evolves into the actual system. The idea here is that a prototype is a substitute either partly or completely for the requirements document. If we try to evolve the prototype into the final system, then we are already talking about iterative and incremental development. It basically looks like this. This is the most important model because it relates to agile model, and this is the one that is most widely used these days. So it says that we need to do some high level requirements. We need to understand at least at a high level what we want to do. In agile speak, this would be populating the first version of the product backlog. So we try to understand what we really need. And then we try to specify it, and we do an architectural design. So we try to figure out what the big components of the system are and what their interactions will be. And then we split the whole thing into builds. Basically what it says that we split it into several sequential small waterfall projects. So we take a component or a part of the system, we plan it, we design it, we implement it, and we test it. But it's not the whole system. And then we do many of these. And this way the system grows. So for each build, we do a detailed design, implementation, and integration test. So if you say that we build, let's say, a house using the waterfall model, we have drawings, then we'll build the walls and have everything put together all at once, like this. That would be the idea. We'll bring everything there and just put it together. If we do build a house using incremental development, we would first build, we would view it as building a structure and adding things to it, which of course is what happens with houses also. But then we would plan, for example, only the walls first, and then plan, do more detailed planning of the interiors only when the walls are there. In the waterfall model, we would build the whole house and have all the plans and build everything at once. Here, we would build the walls first, and then the architect makes all the real decisions when you build a house. She will go there saying, oh, I think we will have that wall over here, and we need to make room for the sofa here, so we need to do it like this. And then you would evolve the plan as you build. Whereas in the waterfall model, everything would be fixed completely before building starts. In the incremental model, you do stages, but between the stages, you can be flexible to a degree. So each build adds functionality. And here, we already had somebody say that we can do prioritized requirements. So here you can say that in the first builds, you do the most important requirements. And in later builds, you do less important requirements. So you build the system starting from the most important functionality or most important architectural elements. So here, the idea is that instead of planning everything at once, then building everything at once, we do an overall high-level plan, and then we plan the details and build as we go along in build. So we grow a system instead of building it. It's like doing a skeleton first, then adding the meat, then adding the skin, and so on. Each iteration is a self-contained project. So the idea is that all iterations produce something that works and that could be theoretically shipped. So we have integration and quality assurance testing in all increments. At the end of each iteration, we basically should be able to do a release that means that we can ship it. It's stable, it's integrated, and it's tested, partially complete system. And after the final release, then we can then ship the complete product. There are many ways we can prioritize requirements. Very often we use the Moscow model, which says that we divide them into categories: must, could, should, could, and want. And the must requirements, for example, would be the one that we implement first. So we put high priority requirements into early increments. High priority can mean things that the customer really wants the most, without which the system is unusable. It can mean technically difficult things that we need to figure out as early as possible. The idea here is that during each increment, the requirements are frozen for that increment. So there's no changes going on to the requirements for an increment while you're building it. To put some time frames here, if a waterfall project, typically waterfall projects in large organizations that have these formal document-driven processes are planned to take 1 year and they take 2 or 3. Which means that when you start seeing real software, you are somewhere around month 9, 10, or well into the second year before you have anything running. And then you're in a mode of working to get to the undoable and change requirements. The incremental model, splitting into builds, early models of this used, typically what we saw in the 80s was 3, 4, 6 month increments. So instead of planning a 1 year project, you planned a 3 or 4 month project, which would be the increment. But this was the cycle time that early models many times used. So we saw this in Microsoft, and many companies used a cyclic model with increments of a few months. The idea here is that we really should be able to deliver value at the end of each increment. Final product typically can better match what the customers need, since they can give feedback in month 3 and say, hey, this is not really what I meant, blah, blah, blah. Then you can do that in the next build, next increment. You can use here early increments as a prototype to help elicit requirements and get feedback on performance and other quality attributes. So you would, using this model, have maybe a lower risk of overall failure. And it's of course easier to plan a few months ahead than it is to plan for years ahead. If you implement the most high priority features early on, since they will be tested in each increment, they will also receive the most testing. A very important part of incremental development, which we also see in agile development that we will talk about next, is that developers like these models too. So not only customers, because they see the actual result in the final system of the code they are writing quicker than in the waterfall model. And if we go to modern approaches, when we have daily builds or continuous integration, you would see the effects of your changes commits immediately. There are also some disadvantages to incremental development. If you don't have a good overview of what you're going to do, it can actually be harder to plan and control than waterfall development. It can be more expensive than waterfall development too. Let's think a bit about that one, because it's an important point to understand. Why do you think it can be more expensive to do incremental development than waterfall development?
There's more testing and more phases that you actually do.
Yeah, you will do more planning, because you will plan each increment every time. So you will have more planning and you will have much more testing, because you test the whole system at the end of each increment. So instead of testing the whole thing once at the end, you will test it maybe 4, 5, 10 times before you ship it, the whole system. So you will have a higher cost for testing, you will have a higher cost for planning. In big systems, for example, testing an increment can be something that takes weeks or months. So testing for complex systems is not something you can do overnight or in a day or two. It can be a matter of even months, and that's one thing that many companies work on, reducing the time for testing. Or let's say it takes 3 days to do a build, then it's pretty difficult to get immediate feedback on what your code meant. Have you ever heard of a company called Microsoft? Some of you? Okay. They used a model called Synchronize and Stabilize in their Office division. And this is an incremental and iterative model that is also based on time boxing. And time boxing is a very important principle that we will talk about. So it looks something like this. You do a high-level product vision, then you do a very, very brief functional specification. The documents here are tens of pages for big systems, not hundreds of pages. Then you divide a project. Their release projects typically have had, at this time when this model was documented, they had release cycles in the Office division where this was documented of 1 year. So they divided that into 3 or 4 builds, taking typically about 3 to 4 months. At the end of each 3 or 4 months cycle, they would have a perfectly tested and running piece of Word, Excel, whatever you want. Each build, it's done very differently from what I just told you. What I just told you, what if they would have done it that way, they would plan each iteration, they will design it, then they would code it, then they would test it, and then they would say, good, now we have worked 3 months, here it is. But of course, that's not how they did it. They did it completely different by having small teams, typically the size of 2 people. So they had the idea that coders and testers are different personalities. If you get hired by us as a tester, you will never become a coder, because then you can't be a good tester, because testers are the people that you won't let into your house because they break things. So they want people who break things. Those are good testers. A good coder is a guy who builds things. And these are different personalities. So a tester should always think about, what can I do to break this piece of software? A tester should never be interested in showing that it works, because that's not the whole idea with testing. The idea with testing is to find problems. A coder as a tester, therefore, is very bad. Because when you test your own software, you very often try to see, well, does it do what it's supposed to do? And that's completely uninteresting. They had the idea that they will pair coders and testers. So they had these teams. They have a feature developer, and every developer is paired with a tester that is full-time testing what the coder does. And they share a room. So you have pairs working together, one coding, the other trying to break it. Then the smaller teams became, you had, for bigger features, you would have several developers and one of them would be called the lead developer. But then we go into, well, how did they plan and do their work? Well, basically, the whole idea was forget planning, it's all about coding. Who wants to read documents? It's all in the source code. So the idea was that they had coffee rooms, they could talk about the code, and then the coders went coding, the testers tested, and they checked in into a version control system without locks. So you check out the file, you change it, some other guy might check out the file and change it. When you check your file back in, you need to do a merge. And there is one sin that you are not allowed to commit, and that is break the build. So they had then not continuous integration, but they had nightly builds. So every night, the software would be compiled and built. And if somebody had broken the build, they would become the next build master. And build master, that was a very fancy way of saying that you will get to spend the night in the office to check on the build. And you will do that until the next guy breaks the build. Good luck. And in some divisions, they also had some beer penalties and a silly hat, so everybody can see that. Congratulations, you are the build master now. They had an idea of peer pressure to get people to not break what's in the configuration management system that will be built every night. And by not locking the system, you could change anything, any file, any time, but you would check them quickly back in, because if you keep a file and for a long by yourself, the risk that somebody else is doing something to that file, which will make your merge difficult, is bigger. So you will check in and out very quickly. Otherwise, you're allowed to do whatever your feature requires. And if you run into problems, you see somebody is working on the same file, it's okay to go and have a coffee, but it's up to you. Rule, don't break the build. This was what they did. This was the development subcycle. And then they had some buffer time, because since you don't do really any good planning, you say, I will have this feature done by end of this sprint. Very often they wouldn't, this iteration. So they had some buffer time. And then the red thing here is actually some stabilizations and internal beta releases. In the last one, the last iterations, they had more testing, which you can see UI freeze, code complete, and final release. Code complete meant that, for example, for the last month, the whole organization went into bug fixing mode. It means no new code is written, everybody tests, everybody tries to break the system, and we try to fix everything as quickly as we can. But this was an extremely heavily coding-based process. No documentation, and you code, and you compile, and you fix. Before you ship, the ship date was always fixed. This was one of the key. This is called time boxing. And what this means is that by May 5th, Word will ship. Exactly what features are in Word on May 5th? Well, we will know on May 5th or maybe a few weeks before. But the whole organization is based upon we have this ship date and we will ship then. And we will ship the features that are of good enough quality. So Microsoft very aggressively took the stance that, well, there is no such thing as perfect software. We will ship good enough quality. That is things that hopefully doesn't break a company's business. For example, if we have some problems with the calculations in Excel, just a few companies might do pretty badly if Excel starts calculating incorrectly. But this was the idea. Time boxing, meaning that these deadlines don't move. And one strength of this was that they could, in these same iterations, they'd had marketing and user documentation writers and everybody working in parallel with the coders. So they would have three releases, two or three internal releases of user documentation and marketing material and so on. So they synchronized the whole organization according to this time box developed process. But the whole idea here was that they have at all times a running product. So every morning you have a new version of the product that is running with whatever has been done during the day before. So this is an example of a model found in industry that is completely different from these more traditional engineering models. There are also lots of other models. We will briefly mention a spiral model. It's in the book, you can read it there. There are formal methods that emphasize this mathematical specification of requirements. We will talk more about that later. They are not really life cycle models. Aspect-oriented software development, we'll talk about that at the end of the course when we talk about some more modern aspects. And one model that I will show you briefly here is a rational unified process. It basically has both phases and iterations. So it's a combination of good aspects of a waterfall model and the iterative model. And this has been quite used, widely used in many organizations. It can be anything from pretty bureaucratic, which is actually the way it looks, into some implementations that can be quite agile. But it separates, if we first look at the workflows, it says that there are things that we need to do in all projects. So we need to do business modeling. That would be answering the question why. Then we do requirements. What do we need to build? Then we do analysis and design. How do we build it? Then we do implementation, we actually code it, and then we need to test it and deploy it. And what this model says is, hey, in most projects, these workflows have different weights. Or you will do many of them in parallel, but with different weights. So in the beginning of a project, in early phases, early iterations, you are allowed several iterations in producing your documents. You can decide the actual number yourself. So in the inception phase, you would focus on the why and trying to understand the what's in requirements. And maybe do just a little bit of design if needed, so you can see that if you need to do some kind of prototype to understand something, it's fine too. So these models give you, in that sense, a lot of flexibility. When you go into the elaboration phase, that would be the design phase in a waterfall model. It says that then you do more less business modeling, you focus heavily on understanding more of the requirements and more of the design, and you will already start ramping up implementation. So these phases from a waterfall sense of view are overlapping. And of course, as soon as you implement something, you should immediately start testing. In construction phase, you do several iterations, but you have a heavy focus on implementation. And then transition means that when you do a transition from development to deployment, then you have most of the focus on deployment. But as all people know, when we deploy a system, we will find new bugs. So that is why you can see implementation and test also going into the deployment phase. And this is a model built by some guys with very, very long industrial experience. So that is why we see that it's, in that sense, not very dogmatic, and you have to have these strict phases. And we have some supporting workflows, configuration management, which we'll talk about in a few weeks' time, and management, and the environment there means building the development, setting up the development environment, which in some projects can be actually a pretty big deal. The rational unified process contains pretty many documents. No, you don't know to know all these. The names of all these documents. You need to see that, oh boy, vision document, initial use case model, initial project goal, so business case, risk assessment, project plan, business model, several prototypes, use case model, blah, blah, blah. You will be doing quite a lot of documentation if you do this model. What you do in practice is you see which of these do we need. The one good practice for thinking about documentation is somebody going to read the document? Then it might be worthwhile writing. And this sounds really stupid, right? But you would be surprised how many documents in certain organization that nobody ever reads get written because a process says that at the end of a project, we do a project analysis and project improvement proposal, and we file it, and nobody ever cares. But some project manager or some other guy has spent a week or two writing that document. A good test for any document that somebody asks you to write is, who will read it? Why will they read it, and what will they do with it?
After you said that, I would like to know document as a strength of waterfall.
It can in many cases be a strength. It depends on, for example, if you need to transfer ownership of a project to another organization. Let's say you build a system, but you will not be developing it in the future. Your client will. In order to facilitate their understanding of the system, that documentation, extensive documentation, can be a good thing. Other reasons might be, for example, let's say you hire new people. For a complex system, it can be very difficult to learn what the system does without documentation. Then drawings and explanations can be very helpful. So that would be some examples.
That's an example of about the documentation. Something goes very badly wrong, and it's very important to have documentation. You can say that which of the parties is the beginning of that problem.
This sounds like some real-world experience, yes. The fact is that many software projects don't turn out the way anybody thought when they started. And in bad projects, they might come a face with blaming, lawyers, lawsuits, and so on, and then that documentation can be good because then you as a developer want to say, well, I did exactly what, it's the client's fault, right? And the client says, it's your fault. And then documentation helps to provide evidence for what actually happened. And in many, many of these cases, of course, so-called experts are called in, well-paid experts, some from universities, that then give statements about what has actually happened. But in many cases, of course, when projects fail, there are very, very complex chains of things that happen that actually make them fail, in some cases. In some cases, it's just actually very simple. But you can see, so there are lots of documents that you can write that it can make sense to write. We will talk more about some of these when we go more into these different activities of software engineering a bit later.
Okay, and that's all I have for you this week. I do hope you have fun reading the material, doing the quiz and essay, and grading last week's essay. As you will be grading the first essays of your fellow students, please don't be too hard on them. And remember that you won't get any points for the essay you wrote unless you remember to grade these essays, so please remember to do that. Our friendly assistants will of course check all essays and also your gradings, so you don't need to be afraid that you will be treated unfairly. They will correct any mistakes that they will find. And with that, thanks for watching, have a great week, see you next week. Bye for now.